a few stragglers walk in, but this is the Lakeside Community. This is our June meeting. It's always the third Wednesday of every month. And our speaker today is going to be Fred Harlan, who's going to be talking to us about transhumanism. But before we get to that, there's a subject I'd like to broach. We have six more months in this year. And if we want to have a meeting every month, we need a speaker every month. So we need six more. I'm going to attach you.
Oh, God.
And, you want to be on?
I'm already on the
test.
I signed up a long time ago.
With who?
With Fred, I guess.
With who?
No. Well, I'm not sure
if it'll be a question. I'm sorry, tell me your name again, please, Fred.
Sandy.
What did you sign up for and with who?
Good question. I mean, he kind of was my important one.
You signed up to speak at a meeting?
Yes, I signed
up. Good.
Yeah, it was the, you asked about the great courses or something. Was it the same? It was on the leaf or...
Was it with him?
Well,
anyway,
it would be good if I knew. I never heard any of this before, Sam.
Now you do.
Okay, and you're welcome to...
I see you this morning.
You
got to
be quick here, yeah.
What did you want to talk about?
I'm talking about the science of belief.
The science of belief. Okay. Well, I call it the psychology thing, but that's okay, whatever, we're going to be talking about.
I've heard the neurology, but...
Okay,
Well, psychology.
And did you want to do that next month?
That was what I was planning on, that's what...
Okay, you can do that.
Somebody, but I don't care.
Okay,
I'll
give you another month.
You want to do it the following month?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we've got Sandy for next month, and we've got Joe for August. And I've got Lloyd Conley for one of the months. Anybody else?
Did you so you know that the middle of August is my birthday, so I expect everyone to bring something.
Well, we will.
Middle of August? My birthday is the middle of August. When's your day? 14.
So happy.
Okay.
I'm not religious, but I'm not religious.
Sandy, I'll need your email address. Can I get that from
Peach Super.
Peach Super.
Mm-hmm. It was a while back.
No, I don't know. You also like?
Yes.
You only didn't understand that from you. Okay. All right. You're fine. You're good. I've seen one of the great courses of Stephen and Mel, and it is a
mine will be a little different.
Okay, I remember that conversation.
I've heard a little from that.
I remember that conversation. And they talked about cognitive biases and...
Yeah, okay.
Okay, that'll be good. All right, so we've got somebody for July, we've got somebody for August, and I think Lloyd had promised he will do one. How about you, Sandy?
I'm Sharon.
I'm sorry.
That's the time. This is my guess.
Okay. All right, so September then, okay. Gotcha.
I have a joke I think on homeopathy. I don't know whether it's appropriate.
You want to do another one this year?
I can. Well, do you think it's an appropriate subject?
You know what? People want to meet. If we don't have speakers, we have to cancel meetings.
Yeah.
I think people would rather come here and hear talk about homeopathy than not.
Yeah.
I know what your business is going to be.
But it's difficult if you're preaching to a whole group that think the same way. It's better to ask. Well, maybe we can invite some...
There is that problem. If everybody here rejects homeopathy, you're hearing the argument against it. Okay.
That's the problem.
Double sound.
Okay. Actually, I read an article recently where homeopathy, one form of homeopathy was only toxic. That's hard to believe. It's so diluted.
Happened too much water.
Okay. I will be in touch with you, Sandy, and if I don't have your email address, I can get you through Philip.
Yeah.
Okay. And please feel free to begin, Fred.
All right. Imagine that you had power, unprecedented, life-altering power to shape the course of human evolution. Imagine you could forever rid the world of disability and disease. Suppose you could extend the human lifespan by 50 or 100 years. What if you could boost the mental power of the human mind by an order of magnitude, or give men and women bodies that in strength and agility could outstrip the greatest athletes of our time? As long as we're imagining, as long as we're dreaming. Imagine stumbling across the fountain of youth, the secret of eternal vitality. I know all of this could sound like far-fetched science fiction, but if we can believe the promises of the bioengineers and nanotechnologists, all of it could soon be science fact. Those words were taken from a sermon written by a Unitarian minister I know back in 2006. That's just over 10 years ago. And I think they still seem apropos today. So my hope for today is that we'll have a conversation about those questions and about what it means to be human in a world on the brink of being reshaped more fundamentally than ever before by scientific and technological developments raising unprecedented ethical questions, such as whether any clearly defined human nature will any longer exist, and whether there is anything about our species that is sacred. I'll talk about all that for a while, perhaps for about 20 minutes, and then we'll talk together. Let me start by talking about Chautauqua, the impetus for much of what I'll say today. Chautauqua Institution, as many of you know, is a community on Chautauqua Lake in southwestern New York State, where approximately 7,500 persons are in residence on any given day during a 9-week season in the summer. My wife, Mardell, and I tend to go every year or two for a week or so. Me, mainly for the great lectures and discussion, and Mardell for that too, but mainly perhaps for the music. They have their own symphony orchestra, and also an opera company, a modern dance troupe, and a movie theater. When we go to Chautauqua, it tends to be a highlight of our year. And this year, Chautauqua did a summer-long exploration of what it means to be human. Each week, exploring a different aspect of that, creative expression, jazz, war and peace, going to outer space, you name it, being human. And we went for 2 weeks. And week 7, and the inspiration for this talk, the theme was pushing our body's limits, focusing on two things. One, the science and technology of pushing the body's limits, what's been happening, what's on the drawing board, and two, its implications, what it means for us. And so for 7 days, we listened to anthropologists, scientific medical researchers, political analysts, transgender activists, theologians, philosophers, some of them strongly in favor of the technology, others very skeptical, worried that all of this amounts to a kind of suicide, an end to our being human. In short, Mardell and I listened to an impressive array of people working in and talking about different aspects of this brave new world. As we listened to all of this, two things became immediately clear. One is that things are indeed changing very quickly, and exponentially so. The other is the enormous power of such rapid exponential change. Concerning these two things, I'll mention two other things: Moore's Law and an Indian fable about chess and rice. Much about the technological change we're witnessing today is connected, even based on electronics and computers. And Moore's Law, a rule of thumb concerning the computer industry, tells us that computing power per unit cost has been growing exponentially. And that's been true at least since 1965. Of course, we should be careful about extrapolating from the historical growth rate into the indefinite future. Who knows how long this will continue? But Moore's Law has been describing a critical driving force of technological and social change, and thus helps explain some of the amazing, mind-boggling things we're witnessing. And here's the fable about chess and rice. The story goes that the ruler of India was so pleased with one of his palace wise men who had invented the game of chess that he offered this wise man a reward of his own choosing. The wise man, who was also a mathematician, told his master that he would like just one grain of rice on the first square of the chessboard. Double that number of grains of rice on the second square, and so on. Double the number of grains of rice on each of the next 62 squares on the chessboard. And that seemed to the ruler to be a modest request. So he called for his servants to bring the rice. How surprised he was to find that the rice quickly covered the chessboard then filled the palace. Indeed, the amount of rice required was far more than existed in the whole of India. Just how many grains of rice is this? In mathematics, it's 2 to the 63rd power, or 2 times itself, 63 times. Enough that the grains of rice on the last square of the chessboard, if placed end to end, would stretch approximately 60 trillion miles. And, if placed end to end, would reach farther than from the Earth, across space to the nearest star, and back to Earth again. That's the power of unlimited exponential growth. There are different versions of the ending of the fable. In one, the king has the wise man killed. In another, he remains in his death and has him marry his daughter. In any case, the story demonstrates that when we have things increasing exponentially, the amount of change is mind-boggling. So, as Moore's law attests, we've been experiencing exponential change for a long time. It's more than 50 years since Moore started clocking it. And as the Indian chess fable demonstrates, exponential growth has powerful consequences. Here's some key examples of these powerful consequences in a variety of science fields. Examples that show how, and in so many ways, we are indeed pushing our body's limits. Take computer technology and three major developments. One, the exponential growth of computing power, Alan Moore's law. Two, cloud computing. And three, the smartphone. Taken together, these three developments ensure that each of us, you, me, each of us, has far more computing power at our fingertips than even existed as recently as the 1980s in the world's most powerful computer. And these computer developments are intricately connected to developments in both artificial intelligence and robotics, which, many would suggest, will soon lead to a world where most of what we as humans do can be done about as well, perhaps better, certainly cheaper, by robots. Which may not come as that much of a surprise in our world, where the computer Watson beats the world's best at chess, and where a poker playing AI routinely beats pros at Texas Hold'em. Those are examples from computer technology. Now take biology and genetics, where through the amazing tool called CRISPR, we can now edit our DNA and genes at will, much as you would cut and paste the document on your computer. And also where, through stem cells, we are beginning to regenerate, make young again, damaged organs of the body, such as the heart and lungs. Take neuroscience, where we're beginning to understand down to the molecular level what our bodies are made of, how they behave, and what causes them to behave as they do. Take nanotechnology, where we're beginning to tinker with our bodies, again, down to the molecular level, using our new neuroscientific learnings to thus change things at the most basic level. Take pharmacology, where we're beginning to developing powerful drugs that use what we've learned in biology, in genetics, and neuroscience. And the list goes on, enabling us to, indeed, push our body's limits. So what are we to make of all that? Of using the amazing new developments in science or technology to change ourselves? And that was the question front and center at Chautauqua, with two main responses. One response, the transhumanist vision, was all about hope and dreams. The vision of human enhancement, of things getting better and better in every aspect of life. The other response, I'll call it sacramentalist after the word sacred, sees much of this as a nightmare and worries that the transhumanist dream would herald the end of our species, would be nothing less than suicide for Homo sapiens. So, two visions of the new developments in science and technology, one of hope, the other of fear. Let me start with the transhumanist vision of hope. According to this vision, there is nothing that cannot, in principle, be changed. That is, there are no true limits. The transhumanist dream, their hope, is through the advancements in science and technology, we can all be made much, much better, enhanced beyond our wildest imagining. They point out that this desire for human uplift, for enhancement, going beyond the human, goes back a long ways, and is expressed broadly in literature, in the Bible. In 13th century, Dante Alighieri, author of the Divine Comedy. In Renaissance, figures like Giovanni Pico. In Shakespeare, in expressions such as, "You are gods, children of the Most High, that you may become participants of the divine." Man is the greatest wonder because he can choose to transform himself. We must become angels. In other words, suggest these writings, there is no fixed humanity. You can choose what you want to be. And today's transhumanists, reflecting on this heritage, ask, is not transforming ourselves and our environments essential to the very definition of being human? So the transhumanists of old dreamed of magical potions, magical times, and magical places. The problem is, though, and today's transhumanists, of course, recognize it, that until now, transformation has never really worked. It seems, for example, that there never was a magical potion, such as in Midsummer Night's Dream, that could make one fall in love with the first person they saw. There never was an elixir of youth, or a magical time, or a magical place like Shangri-La. So transformation never worked. Until now, suggest many transhumanists, through science and through technology, where it's clear to even the most casual observer that living things are becoming more and more modifiable. We're used, for example, to GMO corn. We're accustomed to hearing about Dolly, the cloned sheep, and other cloning attempts. And it's now commonplace to hear of athletes using steroids, of college students abusing cognitive performance drugs. And by the way, Duke University has apparently banned the use of such drugs. Apparently, they give those who take them too much of an edge on their exams. So here's the transhumanist vision that we heard about at Chautauqua. In essence, said the transhumanists, us humanists, are now designed space. It can be designed in any way you choose, and we are the designers. Indeed, are like gods, and might as well get used to it. Might as well get good at it. And we will get good at it, and so it's likely that in, say, 250 years, we will be very different indeed. Perhaps a completely new species. Call us Homo evolutus, man in charge of his own evolution.
Homo who?
Evolutus after evolution. Evolutus. With no need, perhaps, to any longer rely on biology or on reproduction through sex. Is that mere hype? No, say the transhumanists. Much of it's already here, and so much more is right around the corner. Because of the acceleration, exponential growth in scientific and technological knowledge, and the power of that acceleration. So that the pertinent question, perhaps, is not what's possible, but what do you want? If, as they suggest, nothing is off limits, nothing is beyond us. If anything is doable, then it's back to you and me. Are there any obstacles in your life you'd like to have taken care of? Is there anything you want? You name it, and let's get to work on getting it. And you can get what you want. We can make changes at three levels. One change being temporary. In you, for a while. You take a pill whose effects only last 3 hours, but you get an A in the exam and a job interview, and your neighbor doesn't. A second change being permanent for yourself, but not affecting anyone else. You have an insert in your brain that enables you, with study, to become fluent in Spanish in a week. And the third change being permanent all around, for you, for your offspring, and for theirs. So your offspring won't risk, say, having Down syndrome or early onset diabetes, and won't need a chip to learn Spanish quickly. That will have been taken care of genetically with CRISPR technology. And these things are being made concerning so much of us, concerning us physically. You can be much stronger with more stamina and live much longer while still being healthy. Concerning us mentally, you can be much, much smarter. And concerning our moods and morality, there are, and it's being developed further all the time, an array of emotional mood enhancement and moral enhancement drugs. And these drugs, we're told, are so effective because some religious pastors have been tempted to do away with marriage counseling altogether and send couples home with nasal sprays of oxytocin, a chemical that acts as an antidepressant and promotes trust. It's sometimes called the cuddle hormone, like the magical potion I referred to in Midsummer Night's Dream. Some techniques, of course, raise perplexing issues. I can put a magnet on your head and it will change your judgments and you won't even know it. So given all that, the obvious question is, what, in this world we're evolving into, it still means to be human? To which the transhumanists reiterate, perhaps echoing Renaissance's Pico, there is no fixed humanity. You can choose what you want to be. Raising the further question, what would you choose? What's the good life? What's your perfect place? Your utopia? Why not look at your life closely enough and figure out just what's right for you? Anything needing changing? Do it. If all you want is to be healthier, you can continue to diet and exercise. But if you want to be different in other ways, why not take a pill or insert a device? If you want to control your addictions, to be happier, to be morally better, to be more caring, less racist, you could consider taking oxytocin. To be more intelligent, there's always Ritalin. Would these interventions not indeed make you a better person? And why not take something that would enable you to stay healthy while also living longer, much, much longer? How could you not choose these things? Isn't that the morally correct thing to do? And wouldn't it be a nice world if everyone were morally enhanced? If everyone took oxytocin. So, the possibilities seem endless. Indeed, may appear far-fetched and may ask us what it means for us to be human. When are you most human? Is it during sex? We all know we've got a pill for that. But if alternatively you'd like to do without sex, we now have the possibility, you remember Dolly, our clone sheep, of foregoing sex entirely, with reproduction taking place using cloning. So we'll take a single cell of your body and turn it into a new you. Perhaps your sense of yourself, your source of meaning, is intimately connected to your body. As I've said, that can be made much stronger and you can live longer to boot. Alternatively, maybe you're tired of your body, of its aches and pains, and of how it looks in the morning. So maybe you'd like to do without it. Several options for doing that are being explored. In one, they took a slice of the brain of a rat, attached it in some fashion to a robot, and the robot started acting like a rat. Might you like, then, to work with a specially designed robotic body rather than the one you were born with? Other researchers are experimenting with the downloading of consciousness and memory. If they can be digitized, stored with a complete record of all your experiences, do we then have the complete you, albeit free of a body? And what then might it mean to be human? One of the Chautauqua lecturers was bioethicist Jim Hughes, executive director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technology, a think tank that strives to establish ethical policies behind technological progress. In his lecture, he speculated on what parts of his body he would still need for his body still to be the real him, the real Jim Hughes. If I lost my right leg, he said, is what's left still me? Sure. What about if I lost two legs and an arm? Probably. But now, if all I've got left is from the waist up, am I the same person? Maybe, but sex is gone. I can't get around the same. Probably not a trivial manner. Am I sure it's still me? I guess I think so. But what if you kept on going? What if you kept just my head and somehow kept me alive? What then? Or if, like with the slice of brain of the rat, you only leave a slice of my brain and attach it to a robot or keep it going in some vat, is this still me? And what about the rest of my brain that you took a slice out of? Is it also still me? There may be little point, I imagine, in trying to answer Jim's questions, but they may suggest that transhumanism will continue to push the envelope and that we're perhaps in for a bumpy ride. Here's a joke about that. A transhumanist walks into a bar and tells the bartender, get out the good stuff, because I'm having my last drink tonight. Tomorrow I will be leaving this physical reality and sending my consciousness to a virtual world where reality is totally malleable and laws of nature do not apply. The bartender says, what, you going to America? If you cloned Henry IV, would you have Henry V or Henry IV Jr. or perhaps Henry IV part 2? Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was slightly gray. It didn't have a father, just some borrowed DNA. One of the things transhumanists speculate about is extending lifespan. But I wonder if any of them have really experienced aging firsthand, really know what it's like. So I tried to search that out and figure out how you know if you're getting older. And from my investigation, it seems you know you're getting older when your doctor doesn't give you x-rays anymore, but just holds you up to the light. Or when the pharmacist has become your new best friend. When you confuse having a clear conscience with having a bad memory. When you wake up looking like your driver's license picture. And of course, the nice thing is about being senile is you can hide your own Easter eggs. Enough of that stuff. Okay, you've heard my take on the transhumanist vision of its dream of human enhancement through science and technology. Let me now mention three critiques of that vision. First, a sacramentalist critique, one given at Chautauqua by Habitarash Samuelson. Her critique was that the transhumanist vision is not a dream, but a nightmare. The second person I'll talk about is Francis Fukuyama, about equality, inequality. And third, a worry expressed by Yuval Harari, that transhumanists are monkeying around dangerously with potential consequences they don't envision. Okay, first, here's Habitarash Samuelson. She's the director of Jewish Studies at Arizona State University. And she's only too aware that we'll experience profound changes in the 21st century. She insists we need to examine those changes, to understand them, to thus come to grips with what contemporary technology is about to do. Because, she says, it's indeed not trivial. Indeed, by technologizing everything, as we know, with pills, inserts, genetic manipulation, etc., transhumanizes, jeopardizes how we understand the meaning in our lives. Surely, she argues, there is an intrinsic value to nature, to our life as persons, to life as it is. A value we might call sacred, that we shouldn't tamper with willy-nilly. And if, as the transhumanists wish, we choose to change just about anything at will in our bodies, our minds, our emotions, if we choose to become fundamentally different, might that not be the end of us? The end of our species of people with desires, with sex drive, failings, sufferings, hope. In short, suicide for us. And with the demise of our species, the creation of a new and different one. One perhaps without our needs, without our hopes and aspirations, without the very elements that have made us human. Thus, Tirosh Samuelson rejects the notion of remaking ourselves, of so-called designer or conscious evolution. To her, this idea of controlling the evolutionary process is the promotion of a false, likely unrealizable bill of goods, a new Tower of Babel, showing no reverence for what is, no humility, demonstrating the ultimate in willfulness and hubris. Tirosh Samuelson, of course, is not the only one who worries about transhumanism and its agenda. Another critic is Francis Fukuyama, the Stanford political scientist, perhaps best known for his 1992 publication, The End of History. Fukuyama asks whether the fundamental tenet of transhumanism, that we will someday use technology to make ourselves stronger, smarter, less prone to violence, longer lived, whether that's really so outlandish. But he answers by saying that biotechnology's tempting offerings could come at a frightful moral cost. The first victim of transhumanism, he suggests, might be equality. The U.S. Declaration of Independence says that all men are created equal. but he argues the most serious political fights in the history of the United States have been over who qualifies as fully human. Women and blacks did not make the cut in 1776 when Thomas Jefferson penned the Declaration. Slowly and painfully, advanced societies have realized that simply being human entitles a person to political and legal equality. If, queries Fukuyama, when we start transforming ourselves into something superior, what rights will these enhanced creatures claim? And what rights will they possess when compared to those left behind? If some move ahead, can anyone afford not to follow? A third critic of transhumanism is Yuval Harari, the Israeli historian and author of the enormously influential book Sapiens on the history of our species. When people, especially the transhumanists, think about the future, says Harari, they often think in terms of, oh, I want to gain control of my body and of my brain. But he suggests that's very dangerous. If we've learned anything from our previous history, it's that, yes, we gained the power to manipulate things, but because we didn't really understand the complexity of the ecological system, we're now facing an ecological meltdown. And if we now try to re-engineer the world inside us without really understanding it, especially without understanding the complexity of our mental system, we might cause a kind of internal ecological disaster and we'll face a kind of mental meltdown within us. So, that's two broad views of science and technology and its changes. On the one hand, the transhumanist vision of a world transforming itself to meet our wildest dreams. On the other, the sacramentalist fear of a world out of control on the verge of committing suicide with, says Francis Fukuyama, gross inequalities and, suggests Yuval Harari, monkeying around dangerously in things it doesn't understand. So where does that leave us? With two contrasting visions. Remind me of a story about an apparently great problem-solving rabbi, we'll call him Rabbi Sam, who apparently was so effective that other rabbis came in to learn from him how he dealt so ably with people's conflicts, as did the young, relatively fresh rabbi, Rabbi Jacob. When into Rabbi Sam's study came Abe, telling about his problem with Heine. Rabbi Sam listened attentively to Abe and, motioning him out, said, "Well, I don't know, but you're right." Abe went out chuckling. In came Heine. Again, Rabbi Sam listened attentively, this time to Heine. When Heine finished, Rabbi Sam motioned him out as well, again with the words, "I don't know, but you're right." To which the young rabbi, Rabbi Jacob, objected, "I don't understand. Abe could have been right, or Heine could have been right, but they can't both be right." Replied Rabbi Sam, "I don't know, but you're right." I suspect, on the one hand, that the transhumanists are right when they wish to support the natural instincts of human beings to do more, to participate in the ongoing makings of our world. And when they suggest that Tirash Samuelson's sacramental view is unnecessarily cautious, is insufficiently open to the full liberation of life, and too indifferent to the inherent openness of our unfinished world. So the transhumanists are right. But on the other hand, I think that Tirash Samuelson and sacramentalists like her are right when they insist on the intrinsic value of nature, life, and persons, and when they fear that there are too few constraints on the transhumanists, that they could cause enormous harm. So if they're both right, where does that leave us? Is there another way? Any other way that suggests perhaps that we needn't try to block the transhumanist dream? Such, in any case, is likely not possible. But that we need to be alert to possible dangers and to try to avert them. Dangers such as those mentioned by Fukuyama and Harari of inequality and of monkeying around with things we don't understand. And just as important, I think, is the need to reflect on what in our humanity we really would like to keep. What we found to be most valuable, to be truly good, to identify when we're most alive, most human, and to ensure that those things are conserved, and not inadvertently destroyed or corrupted. Let me take a stab at that. One very important dimension of being fully alive, I think, is captured in the word soul. We talk of certain music having soul, or we say that a remarkable person is soulful. And what we're referring to, I think, is genuineness, depth. Genuineness and depth tied to life in its particulars, in good food, satisfying conversation, genuine friends, experiences that stay in the memory and touch the heart. And soul, too, connects with closely with the word vitality, which is about the capacity to experience tragedy, to have hope. Tragedy that accompanies life's defeats. Hope, so essential to the enkindling of further striving. And I think another area where we could question the transhumanists is their inordinate focus on doing more, getting ahead, outstripping others. Because I sense that a critical dimension of being fully alive is recognizing that it's not in outstripping, in outdoing others, that we are most fully alive and human. On the contrary, I think our common, perhaps universal experience is that we are most alive when we give, serve, care for, when we try to lift up and seek the elevation of others, rather than simply outdoing them. What is indeed good for us, then, I think, is to respect, protect, and enhance such values as soul and vitality and the desire to serve others in the world around us. Because those values express what it means, I think, for us to be fully alive. And I think the transhumanist experiments that fail to do that could amount to a tragic end to the story of life. So that's my talk. And now we'll all talk. Today has been about big questions. Questions concerning the extent to which we can and should push our body's limits, concerning what it means to be human. On the last day of Chautauqua, after we'd heard all the other speakers, both pro and con, it was Michael Sandel's turn to try to pull it all together. You may know of him. He's done TED Talks. He's the Harvard philosopher ethicist who specializes in getting large audiences of people through Socratic dialogue to discuss, debate, and think about big issues. So Sandel led us in a conversation about pushing the body's limits through enhancement and technology. He had people express their agreement or disagreement about a lot of things, and then explain why they agreed or disagreed. So I'm going to follow his lead and ask you some questions, a lot of questions, and engage you with each other in the answers. And if we're going too long in any one question, I'll try to cut you off. But why don't we begin? And I'll be doing five broad kinds of questions. First, some general questions about making changes to our bodies. Second, some questions concerning what changes you'd be prepared to do personally. Third, any reactions to the critiques we mentioned, Josh Samuelson, Francis Fukuyama, and Yuval Harari. And then some questions about going beyond our own bodies and making changes to the environment, specifically by bringing back extinct species, species that once lived, but that we wiped out or something else did. And finally, some questions about the transhumanist agenda broadly, whether you like it, whether there is a fixed nature, etc. So, let's begin. Some general questions first. When we were at Chautauqua, the Olympics were on, so there was some thinking about athletics and all that. And at the same time, Alex Rodriguez played his last game for the Yankees while we were there. And he, you know, was infamous for his use of drugs to push his body's limits. My question, should such use of drugs be frowned upon? And I'm going to ask, say yes, say no. How many people here think use of drugs in that situation should be frowned upon? Bunch of folks. Who disagrees? One. Okay, I think we'll take, we understand why some people frown. Why would you not frown?
Well, I, in general, appreciate concepts like autonomy and self-direction, and if that's what you want to do, I think you should do it.
Anybody on the other side want to say something to Steve about that? Yes?
I agree with that when it just affects you, but in the light of competition, to me, it affects your competitors and your audience, because a lot of competition is paid, right? So.
I'm thinking, for example, the use of steroids by the East German athletes and the repercussions of that for their health. I mean, they were broken people by the time they were in their 30s because of these performance-enhancing drugs that they took.
So another element is the health thing.
But okay, then
that's an argument not to do it, but that's not necessarily an argument to make it illegal.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to cut us off. Because I've got a whole agenda of questions, but I have a follow-up one to this.
Let me just add one more. I think that the use of drugs in athletics skews competition.
Yeah.
I mean, you cannot really measure what the human body can do by itself.
Okay.
So you throw up the results. I mean, there's no question in my mind that drugs do not work, they enhance. But it throws off the results.
And I'm going to close this off now because I've got a follow-up question. You may want to do this. And this question is, suppose steroids were legalized in baseball elsewhere, and suppose we were satisfied, Paul's concerned, satisfied there were no undue health risks, okay? They're now made legal, there's no health risks. Anyone still have an objection to using them? Oh, everybody, yes, you have an objection. Would you like to say why?
It's a feeling. I mean, I can't really explain it rationally, but just this idea of athletic competition should be based on effort and...
Not pharmaceuticals.
But you just asked, is there an objection to using it? Yes, I wouldn't use it. But I thought the question asked before was, do I have an objection to other people having the option to use it?
That is the question. And Phil, you were going to say something?
Well, should we ban nutritionists on sports teams? Where they, teams have
sure.
knowledge of nutrition. But or training techniques.
Or about education. Shouldn't we ban that? It gives educated people an advantage.
Yeah.
I mean, they get better jobs.
Well, yeah, okay. And this is exactly the issues. So let me ask a follow-up. Would it be wrong to modify your genetics to improve your athletic performance?
Not per se. Not in a moral sense.
As long as you disclose stuff like this, it's not a problem. And I was going to add that to the drug debate.
Yeah.
If you say, okay, I'm a steroid user, I'm going to compete against the other steroid users. As long as you don't hide it where people accept that, that's fine. But maybe you have different categories. I mean, we don't compete.
Maybe you want to have two Olympics, one third.
Like we do right now for a handicapped and non-handicapped. Yeah. So you have several different categories for the enhanced versus non-enhanced. People get to pick and choose. What's wrong with it is when they do it clandestinely and try to take advantage of their opponent who doesn't do it.
Right.
So that's where the words are more.
But they would do it openly if they were allowed to.
If you could do it openly and it was cool,
okay, I've got a little tweak on that. Your question: does anybody remember Rosie Ruiz?
Yeah, she's the Boston Marathon.
She was the winner in the female category for the 84th Boston Marathon in 1980, only to have her title stripped 8 days later, when it was discovered she had not run the entire course.
She started at the end.
Yeah, she's believed to have jumped onto the course about a half mile before the finish, had traveled much of the race on the subway. So, here's my question. Is there a difference in principle between using steroids or gene editing or the subway in order to come in first in a race?
Yes.
Who thinks there is?
Of course, everyone.
Ask who does. Anybody think there isn't a difference? Oh, we don't have to explain to them. We'll let you say anyway. Well, what's the difference between using steroids and using the subway?
Well, if you're allowed to use the steroids openly, one's cheating and one's not.
Okay. Sure.
What about the guy in the Olympics with the amputee with the springs?
South African?
Yeah.
Okay, and then you start getting into, well, what if you could use special shoes that, had springs in them and let you
sure.
run faster? And what if you could put a frame on your body that pushed your body.
Or Tiger Woods had laser surgery so he could see much, much better.
But at what point is that cheating? Or at what point,
Paul?
I think the two categories are natural or unnatural, and you can debate that endlessly. You know, what is natural and what is unnatural.
Right.
Well, what's natural today is different from what's going to be natural tomorrow, especially when you start getting into gene things. If you change the genome, then it's inherited.
It is a slippery slope, though.
All right. This
natural steroids are okay with synthetic steroids.
This is complex. It's slippery, all that. So let's move on to another area, okay? Concerning what you would be prepared to do to yourself personally. First question. What if you could boost the mental power of your mind by an order of magnitude? You've just learned of an implantable disc, quite affordable, posing apparently little risk, that would make you, as I've mentioned before, a lot more intelligent. Will enable you, for example, with study, to become fluent in Spanish in a week. Would you buy the disc? Who would and who would not?
You said it's risk-free?
It's cheap.
You said it's risk-free.
Risk-free, yes.
Well, who wouldn't?
Okay. Okay. Who would not buy the disc? Who would buy the disc?
Who would steal the disc?
Okay. Tell me why you would buy the disc.
Me?
Yeah. Or any of the
why
people.
Why would I want to be more intelligent, risk-free? Well, how can I say no to that?
All right. Somebody who said no, why? What would you say to him?
But you haven't given a reason. You've just.
I want to be more intelligent.
You want to be more intelligent.
You want to speak Spanish fluently?
Yes. I've spent the whole 7 years I've been down here trying to learn, and I'm still less than halfway there. Yeah. I'd like to finish it this week.
Okay, let me ask a follow up question on that. Would you encourage your children to have a CRISPR treatment to ensure that they and their offspring would be similarly more intelligent?
Again, risk free?
Yeah.
If they're under 18, I'd make them do it.
Okay. How many people here say yes, I would? Who would say no, I would not?
No, we leave it up to them.
Not if they're under 18.
Okay, would you?
Yeah,
Would you encourage them to do it?
No, I would. I would not discourage them either. I mean, I would be with one. I think that's a personal decision.
You wouldn't have an opinion about making your kids more intelligent than no risk.
No, that's a personal decision. Okay. Besides,
I would have an opinion, and I would share that.
In our family, it's not possible to get more intelligent.
Okay. I've got another question. If you heard of an affordable treatment that could extend your life by 50 years, and if you were convinced that any risks were manageable, would you be prepared to undo it?
No.
Who would do it? How many say yes?
I want to hear without the risks.
Okay, without the risks. Okay.
Am I going to be drooling for 25 years?
Okay.
My quality of life?
If you were convinced that the risks were manageable, like the same way, anytime you buy a bottle of pills, it says something about things and you ignore them, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, so you're convinced it's manageable. I don't know, maybe there was a label on the thing, but you're convinced it's doable. Would you be prepared to take a treatment that would extend your life by 50 years?
Who 50 is a quality year.
Yes.
And you're going to still age?
Because you're going to take it, roughly you're 30 years old, you're very healthy, this is going to give you 50 years of healthy life.
Okay.
Of healthy life.
Like meds are very easy.
Okay, some people I think were saying no to this. Who says I would not do this?
I would not.
Why? You would not do this because?
I am 96 years old.
Aha!
I can see a time when I would not be very interested in continuing in this life. This may be 5 or 10 years from now, I don't know, but I probably won't live 5 or 10 years more anyway. I can't see any point of wanting to live 50 years longer.
Now, why? Could you imagine if you had known about this when you were 30? Might that change your view on that?
Well, probably not, because when I was 30, I would expect that I had a life expectancy of another 60 or 70 or years or so.
Right, instead we're going to give you 110 more.
Well, at that point it wouldn't be very, very interesting,
Okay.
What's the difference,
Mardell, why did you say no?
Because already I can't understand what my grandchildren do, and
I've got that problem too.
And I'm not... Is just getting life's getting stuff I don't understand.
Yeah.
I would add this.
I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
Okay, I have trouble hearing you too. That's probably the distance. Now, I would say that, life must have a meaning. Just being alive, it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
Now, if you could have 50 years more or whatever, where you could contribute and feel like you're doing something, then that'd be one thing. But when you get old, older, and I'm sure around, you can attribute that, you go to the front door to open the door, and you need to sit down 5 minutes to catch your breath and do that. Another 50 years of that is not very attractive.
No. Okay. Well,
didn't you include that you don't age, you don't degenerate in those 50 years? Didn't you say that?
Yeah. That's okay. Anything further on that one, Sandy?
Well, I would have to know that my family would be taking it too. I wouldn't want to outlive all of them. I wouldn't want to see everybody die. That would be horrible.
Aha.
It is horrible. That's about where I'm at.
Yeah, I mean, your kids dying here, that would be no.
Well, it's not so bad, but yeah. I mean, your friends.
Yeah.
Your kids not so bad.
Yeah, your kids hurt.
I think we had a comment here.
If I had the option today, the state of health that I have today, and I was given an option of 50 more years, I would take it in an instant. My concern would be running out of resources because I'm retired, so I don't know
what
comes.
So yeah.
That's a concern. So that would be a problem that have to be solved. My mother is...
You can always guess your age, Thomas.
My mother is 97 years old and still of sound mind. Has outlived all of her friends, still finds quality of life worth living, still has an excellent spirit, still is engaged mentally. Lots of aches and pains and an old body, but still, from her point of view, a good quality of life and certainly one that I would accept. So, I'm much healthier than my mother, 50, 60 more years. What drives me, and I understand outliving your friends, that's a big burden for my mother. I'm just so curious, you think of transhumanism. What is the world going to be like 50 years from now?
Right.
I am so curious because there are so many open questions that we can have a nice conversation about, but we can't really answer them. We will have to observe how this is going to play out. And I would just love to keep observing this. There are so many fascinating possibilities. Designer babies. The technology is almost there right now. We haven't even begun as a society to make laws around that. If we don't do it, in Western society, the Chinese or the Indians, somebody will do it, the Russians.
Yeah.
We are going to have, in my lifetime, probably the birth of a designer baby with enhanced intelligence.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on.
Okay.
Thank you. Sleep. We need to sleep, but often it feels like an inconvenience, as if we could achieve more without it. What if we could, through drugs or engineering, banish sleep and stay awake for a week or a month or a year, and what if we're safe? How many would like to do that? How many would be opposed? Okay, well, why would you like to do that?
Two days for the price of one.
All right, 2 days for the price of one. Who's opposed? Why are you opposed to that?
I like to read. I'm good to read for 3 or 4 hours a day. I don't need 12 hours. I'm mentally exhausted. So just to have more time needs a lot of other things. More energy, more people to talk to.
I'm assuming that comes with it. Otherwise, you may not be tired.
Well,
I mean, two full days. 2 days. You just never feel like you have to sleep. That's great.
Yeah, but I have days that I don't feel adequately now. So I'm not at all.
I was, when answering the question, yes, I was assuming you get 2 full healthy days, not 1 day and then you're dragging for the rest of the
day. Yeah, let's assume that.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
I'm in.
Yeah, and you could choose to have downtime. You could choose to meditate. You could have a little siesta if you want. You just wouldn't need it, right?
Right.
Anyone else wouldn't want it?
Well, if I couldn't fall asleep, I wouldn't want it. Uh-huh. I'd be like, you know, that thing of sleep rattle, what is it?
Sleep of care? Rattle,
sleep of care or something like that. I really feel like you feel like in the morning, a new day. I really feel like you need that break psychologically. Just to feel
like that the whole day.
No, but I don't mean the energy. I mean just this feeling
of. So you do want a break, is what you're saying.
I think yeah. There's a biological rhythm. I've often speculated. What if we had like 24-hour daylight and we never slept? What would life feel like? It would just feel like continuous. It would feel like there's no break. There's no stop. You know, there's no reset.
For example, you could just sleep for 1 minute.
If it's nighttime and everybody else is asleep and I'm the only one awake, that's a problem too.
Any other things on this? Okay. Grouchy spouse. Your elderly spouse is not well and getting hard to manage at home. He's also a bit grouchy. You worry that he might, in the nursing home you've arranged for him, act out, even become violent. You've heard about a new drug, oxytocin, that makes cantankerous people less so. They become friendly, caring, trusting. Should you get some? How many people would get that for your spouse? How many would not? Okay.
I think we're assuming a lack of complexity about these things.
Yes.
All these questions are predicated on a lack of complexity.
Yes.
I mean, like, we have... You know, people take serotonin because they're depressed. They take dopamine. Men take testosterone. All of these things are very imperfect, you know. I mean, we're just underestimating the complexity of the human brain. So, to me, this is pie in the sky. A lot of this
stuff. It's pie in the sky, but we're answering the questions as they're being asked.
Yeah, true.
You're doubting my caveats.
Yes.
Yes, yeah, I don't think...
None of this stuff I'm do risk-free, and I wouldn't do any of it. But the way you ask the question, it's risk-free you get to do this. Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Yeah, the way you framed the question.
And you did that, you've given it to your spouse. Would you also encourage some of your friends to take it?
I'd take it.
But you're not.
Water supply.
I thought, Henry, we thought you were already perfect. It's
I had this exact problem with both elderly parents. Very difficult to manage at the same time, and I basically took the psychiatrist and said I need something. You know, they're in dementia, they're going downhill fast. Well, I wanted to reestablish some quality of life for them, and if that was through drugs, that was okay because I knew it wasn't going to be much longer anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the psychiatrist was luckily very cooperative, but it's basically. You know, you give painkillers for physical pain, why not for psychic pains? People are paranoid, they're terrified, they're angry, and I was 100% for it. And we had to manage the side effects, but it's like, well, she may die earlier. It's like, she has Alzheimer's.
I'm going to guess, Risperdal or Xanax?
It was neither of those. It was something with schizophrenia.
Seroquel.
Seroquel, yeah.
It was great, you know, DuPont's
model. And it's very tiny.
DuPont's motto, better living through chemistry.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm not sure if it helped or not, it had side effects, but it was still worth it.
Here's a question that I assume is very straightforward. Let's see. I'd made the thing earlier. Imagine you could forever rid the world of disability and disease. Okay. We can now, using CRISPR, edit our genes almost at will. You've just heard of a clinic that uses CRISPR to significantly reduce the chance of your children or theirs ever developing Down syndrome or early onset diabetes. And although Paul wants a quibble on this, we're going to assume that they're relatively risk-free. Both diseases, Down's and diabetes, are prevalent in your family. Would you consider going to the clinic? Who would?
Who would?
Who would? Who would not? Okay, so we're not going to explain that.
Next question.
You and your spouse can't have children, but would like them. A local lab is asking for a volunteer to donate a cell using a painless scraping of a bit of skin from your finger that would be used to produce, somewhat like with Dolly, the cloned sheep, a cloned version of the volunteer. Would you volunteer? Who would volunteer? Who would not? Okay, Phil, why would you volunteer?
Well, I don't see that. I'm not seeing the argument against it.
What's the argument for?
Okay.
What's the argument for? You want to have children?
Yeah,
you want. He wants to have children.
Clone of yourself?
No, you just want children, but you can't have them. So you take the next.
You're talking about a clone of yourself. You
But I'm assuming that nurture will take care of the difference.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, they won't have had me as their. You know, I wouldn't have had me as my father.
Okay, somebody who said I wouldn't do that, want to explain why?
Creepy.
No, I have no. I don't have any children.
That's the most scientific thing you've ever said. Think of all the people.
It's not of any interest to
so
me.
At least you've got a good base.
I mean, the clone.
That's right.
Now, we have a number of conversations going on simultaneously. Just say, Paul.
The clone would be another you.
And you might have to speak a little louder.
But only physically, not mentally.
Yeah.
No?
No. Oh. You know, we'd have the same connections, but unless you were brought up in an identical way, you'd be a totally different person.
Oh, okay. In different environment, different
exactly.
Person.
You mean you're not, your father isn't involved, you're involved.
Well, they have a different memory. Different
anyone else like to explain why they wouldn't do it?
Well, you know, I think that there are an awful lot of others at risk. And, if I could not have children, I think I would prefer to raise a child that's already there.
You would prefer to?
To raise a child that's already there.
Aha, adopt. Aha. Rather than having one, yeah. Now, this is assuming that you want that you really want one, but you're saying that you have another way.
Approach, which you're suggesting.
Any other comments on that one about cloning yourself?
Well, if your genes really exist to make copies of themselves. It seems like you'd be twice as inspired, to go this route. Because you don't have to dilute your gene set with your genes.
Mardell, were you?
No, they haven't. Well, you're
going to ask
him.
Okay. We'll go on here. Would you buy some glasses that would enable you to spend time, any amount of time you want, in a virtual world where you have enormous power, no limits in what you can do, you're able to save others in the world by recognized by all as truly heroic? Who would buy glasses like that?
What kind of glasses?
They're glasses you put on and they enable you to live in a virtual world with enormous powers. You're a hero and everything.
I've had those on and it's not terribly exciting. I tried several scenarios and I couldn't shake the feeling that this wasn't a real thing, even though I fell off my chair a couple of times. Because you look around, up and down, and things happen and all that. And it's weird, but I could not, remove this thing that this was not the real thing.
So it wasn't working with
him. I mean, I'm assuming you don't have to stay there if you don't want to.
No, you can pull them off.
Yeah,
sure. But
yeah, I'm in, sure.
Yeah.
It's and, like a game.
But some people maybe would like to spend most of their lifetime. Bob?
That sounds like the dilemma of the lotus eaters. You become a follower of the lotus eater, and you never come out of it.
But you're heroic all the time. Isn't that you're
in
marvelous?
In your own mind. it's false.
Any other comments on that? Because that is a huge area that's burgeoning in terms of the... Okay, we'll move on. Okay, second general area. Third, you heard me give some critiques. Tirosh Samuelson, Francis Fukuyama, and Yuval Harari. First, how many of you are inclined to agree with Tirosh Samuelson that transhumanism's dream of controlling the evolutionary process is likely false, but if realized, would be tantamount to committing species suicide?
Too soon to make that judgment.
Pardon?
Too soon to make that judgment.
How many people, you're saying I'm not going to do both. How many people agree with that, have that impression, that this is suicide?
Will be or might be?
I don't know.
The word suicide puts a negative connotation on it.
Yeah, and she did.
Yes, but if you use the word supersede, it puts a different connotation on it. I'm all for the further evolution of the species through transhumanist types. But the word suicide in the question gets in my way. Not the idea in the question.
But the sense that she was getting was, it's the end of us, it's the creation of something else.
Well, I agree with that, but I would say that's a good outcome.
Yeah.
Well, are we then going to be the Homo Neanderthal to the Homo sapiens?
Quite possibly, yes. Hopefully, yes.
I guess the thing that bothers me most is that you're kind of assuming that all 8 billion or however 10 billion or whatever there is in the world are going to be able to take advantage of this by the time it comes along. Are going to be able to take advantage of it. Of course, that's not true. It's going to be a little elite group that's going to be able to take advantage of it, and they're going to have all this power over everybody else.
Well, let me ask, we'll get back to that, because that's my next question. Phil?
The human species is doomed anyway. Yeah, I mean, all species are doomed, let's put it that way. Right? Eventually. Being evolution hasn't stopped. We're not a pinnacle. You know, we will go one way or the other, right? Either for natural reasons, and I balk at the use of synthetic. Because I think, whatever we engineer is natural.
Okay, then let me ask Sandy's question. Francis Fukuyama. How many are inclined to agree with him that the changes envisaged by transhumanism would likely lead to intolerable levels of inequality?
At the beginning, but not later on. Just like every new technology.
Okay, just somebody who wants to say why they think it would be intolerable, the levels of inequality.
I think we're skirting around the line. On one side is utopia, on the other side is dystopia. It's kind of like Janus, the coin of Janus. You familiar with the woman, the two-headed coin? And it's kind of like that. Which side, when you flip it, which side will really come up? The utopia or the dystopia? The equality or the inequality? And by nature of what we see in today's world, I'm afraid that dystopia will win out.
Yeah, I agree.
Any other people want to follow up on Bob's thing of saying I'm really worried about that?
Well, I agree with almost everything Bob said except the conclusion. I would come to a relatively optimistic conclusion. I agree with what Sandy said. It would start small and there would be a great deal of inequality, but we're talking about the birth of a superior species, and that's an outcome I'm personally in favor of.
Okay, 46 million years ago, this mom gave birth to two kids. One of them went on to become a gorilla. The other one went on to become Homo sapiens. If you're talking to the gorilla, is it a good thing for the gorilla that this other thing happened that's now going to keep him in a cage? How do you...
I want to answer the previous question about what you said. And that is, just as an example, that's happened very recently, the invention of cell phones seems to contribute. But today, pretty much everybody in the world has a cell phone. At the beginning, there were pockets of the haves and have-nots. But within 50 years, everybody has a cell phone.
You have people in Somalia where about 8 million people right now are on the edge of
starvation. A lot of them have cell phones. Believe it or not, cell phones are everywhere. So, if they can buy a cell phone,
they can buy food first.
And the point is what?
This advantage, just in a good world, this advantage distributes itself very quickly to almost everybody. Of course, there's always going to be early adopters and rich people and stuff like that who get it first. But if it's generally accepted as a plus, it goes pretty mainstream.
Cell phone doesn't give a clear advantage of those people who have them over a strength advantage, an opportunity advantage of people who have them over people who don't, like vastly increased intelligence.
And I, you know, I
most
of those people have that. They're not going to say, "Ooh, we want everybody else."
Okay, then a follow-up question.
Question. You know, you're saying that even in those poor people, the people that are hungry, they still have cell phones. I know I don't have a cell phone. One of those things like you have in your hand. My son was here just 2 weeks ago, and he pays, I think, $80 per month, U.S., you know, for his cell phone. Now, it's true that he can go anywhere in the world, which he does, and he can find his way around. I mean, it's really something. He was also the one that gave me this, or at least, let me try this thing you put on your head, and you can see all these imaginary worlds. But I cannot imagine that all these millions of people that are now literally on the edge of starvation, can't come up with that kind of money to have a cell phone. Maybe somebody hands them one, here and there, but then the thing is not going to work unless you pay, your monthly fee.
We have a number of discussions. Paul?
I think a lot of people would argue that there's intolerable levels of inequality in the world already. I mean, what John was just saying, potable water. There's millions of people don't have water that's safe to drink, So, it's intolerable, but we're tolerating it.
Well, then if everybody just had decent nutrition, that would be a huge leap forward in intelligence and, vitality for the species, and yet we can't seem to manage that.
Then a little twist on that. Might one person becoming more intelligent pressure other kids or their parents? Do you think the pressuring kids to become better, etc., could be a problem? These kids are now much more intelligent and better athletically. Does that pressure these other kids to want to do the same?
Sure.
So, do you want a world, and you're saying maybe we already are pressured? Or?
Yeah, we're there.
Okay, then, another one, and people have already mentioned this.
Brett, you mentioned intelligence.
Yeah.
Now, are you in any way supposing that it will be possible in this future transhuman to improve creativity? I mean, we're taking this very one-dimensional view of, human quality that is intelligence, so we never like to, or even physical performance.
Sure.
But there are other dimensions that measure our quality as people.
All of which can be enhanced.
Well, that was my question.
Yes, right. But creativity can be enhanced.
Creativity is not the
same. But when they chose to enhance.
Well, it's a type of intelligence. You're playing with definitions of words.
Just about any
human characteristic can be enhanced.
Well, let's say compassion.
Sure.
If you had would people choose to do that? Would people choose to enhance? The rich people in the world right now, the 1% that's running everything, they have never chosen to enhance their compassion.
Because they can see a
distinct advantage in not enhancing their compassion. They rationalize completely to themselves the advantage they have of not being compassionate. And I just can't imagine people doing that.
And there are twists. If you try to work on compassion, do you know what you're doing? And that's the next question. Harari, monkeying around with things we don't understand. And he said, ecologically, a lot of things we did now are producing climate change, whatever. There's a lot we don't understand. He said, without really understanding the complexity of our mental system, could changes that we make cause a kind of internal ecological disaster, a mental meltdown inside of us? How many of you would be worried about that? A lot. How many would say no? Okay, so everybody feels that could be. Because there are a lot of mental things, but one thing links up with another.
How many would say it's a risk worth exploring?
Yeah.
Now my hand goes up.
We're a risk either way.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
It's too black and white.
My questions tend to be.
Let's go back to your virtual world where you're the hero. Essentially, hero gives you that same aspect. you know, and are we, do we think that that's great, that somebody can go anytime they want into that by using heroin? I guess if they can keep up their lives, but if once they've gotten to the point where that's all they want to do, which I can definitely see happening.
Sure, yeah.
We're already complaining about everybody, you know, it's addictive, it's had side effects.
One of the biggest risks that very intelligent people are very worried about is that when we create super machine intelligence, we will create an alien mind. That's very much an open question. And there is no consensus on the answer, but there are some very impressive people very worried to the point of saying, stop the research.
Like,
yeah.
But I'm not even talking about, I'm talking about a human mind who would rather withdraw from humanity because this other thing is so much more human.
Well, you can enhance the brain to the point where you essentially, that brain generates an alien mind.
You're aware that 2 weeks ago, there was a guy at Open Circle talking about this very...
Yeah, precisely.
That's true, yeah. We only have 15 minutes left. I have a couple more things I want to touch on. Okay, you've joined the ethics committee of an institution that's dedicated to biodiversity and genetics research. And this institution has three kinds of things they're doing. Preventing extinction of any at-risk species, bringing back species that were once extinct, and creating wild areas that will make it easier for them to be able to, in fact, live well. So they do, they have a three-pronged thing. Current ones, don't let them get extinct. Old ones, bring some back, and have good environments for them to live in. Now, you're on a committee that is going to be examining some new proposals. Here's a proposal, and the question is, would you likely vote to approve this? A proposal to reintroduce passenger pigeons, once endemic to North America. Pigeon meat was commercialized as cheap food. It was hunted massively. The last wild bird shot, we think, in 1901. Who would likely vote to approve bringing back the passenger pigeon? Who would not?
No point in this.
Depends what the other choices are.
Well, each of these things is actually it's being actively investigated right now, and people and money is being created. Like, these are things. These are not hypothetical in the sense of not being considered. There are a variety of them being considered. Passenger pigeon is one, but one reason for bringing it back, presumably, is we were nasty people in wiping it out, and it was such a wonderful part of the ecology. Who would not do this? Why wouldn't you?
At the time that the last whatever becomes extinct, life, evolution, and change continues. And to bring it back is, you know, and expect that, oh, you know, things will just go back to normal. I suppose in relatively short times that wouldn't be a problem. But when you're bringing back older species, a lot of things have changed.
Some of them changed because that species died.
The idea that we can understand and know those changes, understand them, manage them, control them, that's just pure arrogance.
Okay, well, how about then, if you mentioned passenger pigeon, it's relatively recent. Another proposal is to bring back the woolly mammoth. It disappeared about 10,000 years ago, most likely through hunting by us and through climate change. Who would like to vote to approve bringing back the woolly mammoth? Why?
Why? Well, it would be very interesting to see what they're really like, because we have all these theories about how we think they live, so we can see how they really live, how much it matches up with our theory. Number two, we'd probably learn quite a bit by bringing it back. Number three, at least for the time being, I don't see what harm it would do. I don't think we're going to get overrun by woolly mammoths, so let's bring them back and see what they were like.
Are you talking about a dozen woolly mammoths in a lab or a zoo, or are you talking about a herd of them in the wild?
Well, what we're going to do initially is bring back
one,
and then because of the wild we've created, we're going to have 1,000. Right?
Well, you need at least one of these
Paul?
Species.
How about bringing back the Neanderthals?
Okay, that was my next question. Paul says, let's move on. And let's reintroduce the Neanderthals. They probably went extinct about 40,000 years ago. Maybe due to contact with us. We're not sure because they also bred with us. That's a little bit complicated. We share about 99.7% of the DNA. So pretty closely connected. Who we vote to approve to bring back the Neanderthals?
You mean have more Trumps around?
They all have to go to Alabama.
Anybody want to bring the Neanderthal back? Okay, nobody does.
No. Thank
okay,
you.
Those are questions about other species. Now I want to just close by talking about the transhumanist agenda. Here's a comment. It seems to me that we've been talking about in humankind, we're a species at the juncture, I think, of two contrasting impulses. One, the transhumanist one, is reflecting in the word molding. We want to change things. We want to make things better. Anything can be done. And the other one is reflected maybe in the word beholding, where we revel in and celebrate what is. Do you want to make things different, or do you want to revel in what is? And I'm going to ask a question. Who basically would see it one way or the other? Who would like to support the transhumanist thing broadly of trying to mold things and make them better? Who would likely broadly oppose that and say, let's take care of what is, how wonderful this world is? Okay.
You flipped it.
Okay. I'll pull back to how wonderful, but we can celebrate. Okay. People who would like to do the molding and so on. Somebody want to say why broadly we think we should try to change things and make them better.
Why we should try to change things and make them better?
Yep.
That needs an answer?
Yes.
Because that's what we do. We improve the human condition every way we can.
Oh.
And occasionally we mess it up. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Okay. In general, we try to do the right thing.
Would someone like to challenge Stephen on that?
I think your question is a bit unfair. Is
yeah.
that, you know, would we like to mold things because we'd like to make things better?
Well,
as
we can't change things.
Better
sure.
without molding.
You can use your own word.
I think the molding implies control, and I don't think we'll ever have the wherewithal to control.
That's different from would you do it if we could.
Well,
what direction would we like to go? I would like to go in the direction of transhumanism cautiously, rather than
sure, of course.
You would argue against that?
Well, cautiously not, but
cautiously.
Yeah,
boy, balance stuff.
So we, you know, can we operate cautiously?
That's right. That's a different question.
Let me ask a question related
to what Phil said. The question is this. Maybe our discussion is not particularly relevant. Do you think if we were to strongly agree, and others were to strongly agree, strongly object to aspects of the transhumanist agenda, that there's anything that could be done about it? Will anybody take seriously anybody doing anything, or is it all a done deal, there's nothing that can be done, so why are you bothering to talk? Who thinks we could do something?
What, to prevent this exploration?
Yeah, to limit anything corporations, research scientists want to do. Is there any limitation the Chinese, you can put whoever out there. Yeah. Is there anything anybody can do that's relevant, even if they objected?
You can slow it, you can't stop it.
Yeah.
Ron?
Yeah.
You think we can make a difference?
Yes, I think we can.
Ron says we can make a difference. Anyone want to support Ron in that? Nobody.
Well, okay.
Why are they so obstinate?
Okay, I would like to say something here. I don't know if anyone else here attended the Open Circle a couple of weeks ago, where we had a nuclear physicist who talked about many of the things that you have brought up today. He did them in a rather different way, however. I mean, I think it was wonderful that you have this idea of asking people what they would like to happen. But he made the point that many of the things that you talk about as potential have already happened or are already possible. Like, for instance, living longer for another 100 years or so. It can be done already. We're just about there almost. In the same way that in Cuba, they keep these cars running forever. They change all the vehicles. So now we can change our different organs and replace them and so on. So it's not a question that you want to live for another 50 years, but you'll be able to. I mean, most people will. And then he made the question that it's not a question of what we can do, but what we should do. And this was the main theme of the last part of his talk. You were there, John, right?
I was there. I heard it.
Do you have any comments about that?
Well, the first comment I would make is that the presentation here was much better than the one at Open Circle.
Yes. Well, he had a...
Are you going to play the sound guy?
No, but there was... I'll say it here. There was too much pseudoscience at Open Circle.
Yes.
So I have a whole problem with the whole presentation of Open Circle.
Of course.
So don't get me started on it. it was presented as science.
Yes.
And accepted by most of the audience. And that was unfortunate. And that's about all I want to say.
Well, he is a nuclear physicist. He directs a very important thing in Jalisco at the moment.
Who is he?
Right? But I mean, okay, so that's not the problem. I forgot what the original question was here, but would I...
Okay,
yeah, right.
Let me close. I know we're almost done time-wise. I mentioned earlier that we need to reflect on what's important to us and try to ensure, and people are saying, I don't know how you can, that... what's most important is not really damning. And I said, for example, I value what's captured in the word soul, genuineness, depth, vitality. And my question to us, is there anything in humanity that you think is so important that you would desperately want to ensure that it not be impaired, hurt? What is there about us? Is there anything that we really, really value and cherish and say, no, don't tamper with that, or make it better, but really be careful with this particular. Anything we think is good?
Our capacity for compassion vis-a-vis life on this planet.
And so many things.
Well, we need a moral compass, we need a reasoning faculty, we don't want to damage those. We might like to enhance them, but we don't want to lose them.
Empathy?
Yeah. Conscience. Here's what I want to know. Can transhumanists use either bathroom?
I bet some of them would like to. Okay. Enough on that. Anybody have anything further they want to discuss on any of this as we close down?
Okay, there's one thing that's been bothering me with that, and when I heard this guy agree with the same thing, I didn't want to bring it up because I thought it was good. Provoke, too many mechanisms. But there are many, I believe, true scientists that do not care if our race more than about 30 more years. You know, and then the way things are going, with the way we are affecting the weather on this planet, and not just the weather, but as a result in all the droughts that are happening more and more, we already artificially had to increase the total lands, where we can raise food, but at the same time, the population keeps increasing. We're well over 9 billion now, and with the arable land has not increased in spite of all the efforts that we've done, and it is decreasing. So here we have a formula where there's going to be less food for more people. And this is a reality. And this is something that's speeding up. And so some give us no more than 14 or 15 years. The most seem to be hovering around 30 years. And then extinction, the human race, will start along with all other you know, a species that eat the green air and eat food. So the whole thing, I think, that you're talking about is very hypothetical. It's interesting, to be sure, as a mental exercise. It looks at the reality is very much against it. I think Paul mentioned that earlier also, you know, it's more or less the same thing.
Phil?
Is transhumanism possible? Because when we get to the point where the technology is there, given our current human nature, we will most likely destroy ourselves. So in other words, technology is self-limited as far as our species.
I don't think we can destroy ourselves. I think we can bend the herd.
Yeah.
It's going to be up to space.
But eventually. We're talking, we're talking in sort of vague time scales here about, what constitutes an end result of transhumanism.
Paul?
But in thousands and thousands of years, we're not going to be who we were anymore.
There are no objective
global warming. We've got too many conversations going at once, I think. Paul?
I think we're just totally underestimating the complexity, for example, of connecting computers to the human brain.
Right.
I mean, you study the human brain, and different parts of the brain govern different functions.
Yes.
How are you going to connect a computer to a person's brain such that it connects to all these different functions that are also interconnected? I mean, the complexity of that task is just incredible. I don't see that happening.
The nuclear physicist 2 weeks ago talked about that at Open Circle. He said, for instance, by imprinting a thing in your brain there, you won't need to use your body. You can do things just by imagining them. I mean, they're incredible things that can happen. But I mean, his main thesis in the end was, and this is a man who knows all about, who's worked on a lot of these projects on nuclear physics. He said, it's not a question of what we can do, but what we should do. We've got all to get together and put some kind of limits on the sort of things that scientists are doing. We've got to decide whether we want all these things to happen.
And yet, Ron, I think what people are saying here is that could be a wonderful objective. I doubt if it can be done. They're saying that's an impossible agenda.
Well, I mean, this man's point was that we should all take this very seriously, and we should do whatever we can to watch what's going on and to object or to vote or to make our ideas and thoughts about this heard, because we could get into an awful... I mean, if everybody's going to live for a couple of hundred years, what's that going to do to the economy? What's it going to do to... there are myriad questions on this. We've got to have some control over it, surely to God.
Basic humanism... that there's no point in going to transhumanism. We're just still so bad. Like I said, just simple nutrition would make a lot of people who are growing up in Africa right now twice as intelligent as they're going to be when they grow up. And we can't even manage that.
Right.
The other thing is, I don't think we really talked about human happiness and contentment and what really creates human happiness and contentment, which everybody says is relationship, which we haven't, I guess the oxytocin might help with that. But also, I think, effort and accomplishment, And so if you can just take a pill and accomplish something that would have taken effort, is that really going to make your life better? I'm not convinced. I've learned Spanish, and I'm very, 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 very proud of myself, and I feel a great sense of accomplishment for it. And I don't think I would feel that if I had learned it from a pill. Well, I could go on to learn Chinese if I was, but you see what I'm saying. It was, to me, it's the accomplishment and the effort and everything that led to my satisfaction, not just the being able to speak Spanish.
Okay, but then you could speak Chinese. You have all kinds of Chinese friends, so you could communicate with them on a much better level than you can right now. And I'll take this as long as I
and a bit of effort. Okay.
Well, first of all, it's all hypothetical whether you could ever have a pill that would let you do that. But right now, Google Translate does a 50% job and it's getting better all the time. It's like,
Okay. Thanks, folks.
You know, we'll get the battle finished.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much.
Every word is down. We're going to have to listen to that.
Very good.
If you can find any of those pills, sign me up.